Today's podcast features a conversation between JFY Executive Director Gary Kaplan and Kevin McCaskill, the Executive Director of Madison Park Technical Vocational High School, the only vocational high school in the Boston Public School System. Mr. McCaskill has been working in education for over 30 years, and between them, Mr. Kaplan and Mr. McCaskill have close to 75 years of experience advocating for public education. In this episode, we'll hear as they talk about Mr. McCaskill's reason for leaving the private sector and beginning a career in education.
Lo and behold, worked at Mass Mutual for 3 years, but just very unsatisfied. I always felt the need to do something greater, working with kids and...
Why urban schools struggle to hire diverse educators.
Yeah.
But there was a residual consequence that occurred because as the schools were supposed to integrate with students, it didn't integrate the educators.
And how technology can be the great equalizer for underserved populations.
The more technologically savvy our students are, they are increasing the access to opportunity.
This podcast was created by JFY Networks, a Boston-based nonprofit provider of remote learning programs to schools, students, and parents. JFY's individualized self-paced curricula help raise individual and school performance measures by maintaining grade-level skills and combating learning loss. JFY provides online ELA and math curricula aligned to state and college standards from grade 6 through high school, with personal support online and via telephone from friendly learning specialists like yours truly. For JFY Networks, I'm Greg Cunningham. As Mr. McCaskill begins his 6th year as executive director of Madison Park, the crowning jewel of the Roxbury neighborhood, he sat down with our own Gary Kaplan for a conversation about education, starting with Mr. McCaskill's own experience as a young student.
Well, look, Kevin, the reason why we're doing this is because you and I have had many conversations over the years, and you know, it's clear to me that you have had a lot of experience. You've gone through a lot of things. You know a lot of stuff. And I thought that you would have some very interesting things to say. Well, look, Kevin, let's start with your personal background. Where were you born?
I was born in Paterson, New Jersey.
Just tell us a little bit about your family background.
Well, I'm a single parent. My mom raised me. I'm my mother's only child. And
really?
Yes, indeed. You know, hardworking. My mother, hardworking woman, she was a registered nurse who worked from sunup to sundown. And, you know, we lived right in the heart of Paterson. So I was a latchkey kid. When I came home, there was no one home.
Really?
Because she was working, again, just extraordinary hours just to put food on the table and paying that rent. And so, you know, you learn responsibility from a very early age.
And you were an only child.
I'm my mother's only child. My father has 3 kids.
I see. But you grew up as an only child.
As an only child.
With a single mother.
A single
mother. My goodness. Is your mom still alive?
Yes, she is. 80 years strong, still living in New Jersey.
In Paterson?
No, she actually moved down to Willingboro, New Jersey, which is right outside. It's like north of Camden, right outside of Camden.
Uh-huh. Almost Philadelphia.
Almost, yeah.
Yeah.
15, 20 minutes from Philadelphia.
Yeah. Huh. Great. And she's in good health?
Yes, indeed. Yes, indeed.
Terrific. Terrific. Well, that must be where you get your strength from. I've never seen you sick a day. Do you ever get sick?
It's rare, but you know, you drink a lot of regular water and a lot of Pellegrino, and that really kind of gets everything out your system.
You got great health.
Thank you.
So tell me, or tell us, how did you get into education as a profession?
Really, it wasn't my original plan, Gary.
It wasn't?
No, it wasn't. I mean, I went to Western. I graduated from Western New England in Springfield.
How did you happen to go there? I mean, you were from New Jersey. How did you get there?
Well, my mother didn't want me to pretty much stick around in New Jersey because she, we knew too many people and she didn't feel I would graduate. But Western New England, I was an athlete in high school. And so I played basketball.
Basketball.
So Western New England really showed a lot of interest in me playing. And really didn't have to wait to play. I could play as a freshman, where some of the larger schools, I would have had to, quote unquote, wait my turn. And at the time, I didn't feel like waiting my turn. So in Western New England, had what I wanted to major in, which originally was, believe it or not, engineering.
Really?
And so it was a great, to me, it was a great opportunity to just go to a place that I'd never been before and you know, obviously get an outstanding education and also get the opportunity to play college basketball for 4 years. You know, I ended up changing my major after the first semester after engineering. I changed it to mathematics because, again, that was a strength of mine.
Yeah.
In school. And so, yeah, I graduated from Western New England in 1984 with that degree in math, a little minor in statistics. I ended up going back to New Jersey, and I actually worked in Philadelphia for a small bit at Penn Mutual Life Insurance Company. 4 months in, during that, we had, if you notice, in the mid-80s, we had the big recessions going, the biggest recession going on, so they laid off about 200 of us. And a friend of mine indicated that, you know, Mass Mutual was hiring. So I ended up coming back to Springfield, figuring it would be very short term. And lo and behold, worked at Mass Mutual for 3 years, but just very unsatisfied. I always felt the need to do something greater, working with kids. And Mass Mutual had a program in which they allowed the employees to actually tutor two days a week. You could actually leave work and just go to a designated school and tutor for the remainder of the afternoon from like 1 to 3 o'clock. And so, yeah, just to get out of work. Yeah, it's a great day. And again, I kind of knew math and I really fell in love with it. I was at the old classical high school in Springfield, right on State Street, and just enjoyed. Couldn't wait till those sessions to occur.
Really?
So I ended up making a decision and taking a huge pay cut and going into teaching. And so in 1988, I began teaching after 3 years in industry. And at that time, I did re-enroll, obviously, to get my certification, but also into my master's in education.
Where at?
Now I was at Westfield State.
Westfield State.
So I ended up getting my master's from Westfield State, master's in ed administration. Fast forward to that, I applied to the doctoral program at UMass in 2007. And after 13 years, you know, still no doctorate, but I do have the, but I'm going through the, I've actually qualified for the Ed Specialist degree, which I'll get probably in December or whenever I decide to pick it up, but I do have the Ed Specialist degree. And at some point in time, will I go back for the master's, you know, I mean, for the doctorate, maybe.
That's
my educational background.
Well, that's a really interesting career trajectory. You come through the insurance industry into education. So that explains how you got to Springfield.
Sure, absolutely. Absolutely.
So you worked in that great big building, the Mass Mutual building.
That Fortune 500 company. I mean, you learn quite a bit about industry, obviously. And I guess in my current position here, you know, being at a vocational school, you know, a career changer, you understand what's needed and what's required to really make it in industry. You know, and at some point in time, you can make a decision that's obviously optimum for you.
So you started out as a middle school math teacher.
Middle school math teacher at Forest Park Junior High School.
Forest Park Junior, is that still there?
It is now Forest Park Middle School. Just for my the educational background, I started as stated, a middle school math teacher, grade 6. I was actually teaching 8th grade math. And I did that from 1988 to 1994. And in 1994, I became an assistant principal at the John F. Kennedy Middle School in Springfield. And I was at Kennedy for 3 years, from 94 to 97. And of all things, in 97, I went back to Forest Park as an assistant principal, which I stayed for an additional 5 years. Wow. And in 2002, I was named principal of the William N. DeBerry Elementary School. So that was a switch coming from middle school down to elementary. But what a great 2 years, even though it was only 2 years, what an outstanding 2 years at DeBerry. And I think at that time, I really got a real understanding and I truly got an education on what true teaching and learning was all about. And just in those 2 years at DeBerry.
Why there? Why did that happen there?
Well, when you're learning at that time, Gary, as you and Greg know, this is where you learn how to read. And when you see in middle school, you're not seeing that process. Here, you're actually seeing at the most fundamental levels, kids obtaining literacy skills. And it's so fascinating on the techniques and strategies that are used from an elementary perspective. And it opens your eyes to what real teaching and learning is all about. How you can have five different activities going on in one class and the teacher is just a facilitator of the learning going forward. It was just an outstanding thing to really see and witness and be a part of.
So you were the principal, but were you able to spend a lot of time in the classroom?
Oh, absolutely. I mean, you don't have many discipline issues, especially when the principal's 3 feet taller than you.
Right. You just say, no.
So that, discipline was the least of my concerns.
But yeah.
But we were definitely in an impoverished area. I mean, right in the Mason Square area, and there's high need students. But the parents and the community were just so open. They were just so accepting and so receptive of everything that we were trying to do.
Wow.
And I think that's when superintendent at the time, Joseph Burke.
Yeah, I remember Joe Burke. Yeah.
Yeah. And I'll never forget the day. It was June 1st of 2004. It's probably the most drastic changes in the history of Springfield Public Schools occurred. Like 16 principal changes at one day. And obviously it was, due to some of the things that were going on in the district with respect to transformation reform and some of the things that the state said we need some change and some shakeup. So I was reassigned of all places to Putnam Vocational without any high school experience, no vocational experience. One of the things I shared with Dr. Burke, I said, hey, doing this, if you want to fire me, just fire me. I mean, why would you send me to Putnam? I mean, at the time, Putnam did not have the best of reputations, as you
know. No.
But it was something where.
Did he explain why?
He just said, well, just go up there. And when I asked him, he says, what do you want me to do up there? And his response was, well, just go up there and do something. And I think it was just a matter of leadership, of really, I hope that I had shown him that I, some of the leadership skills that I possess, and that despite some of the shortcomings of not having the high school experience and not being a vocational experience, again, I think coming from industry helped a lot, in that transition. Yeah. But understanding the fundamental needs of a school, and that there was so much at that school that could be done in a short period of time. And so I ended up being there for 6 years.
Let me just get this straight. You started teaching eighth grade math in 1988.
Correct.
Okay. And then you were an assistant principal and then an elementary school principal. And then from 88 to 2004, you're in middle school and elementary school.
Correct.
And then in June of 2004, without any warning, all of a sudden...
You're in high school, and better yet,
what?
Look at him, and I said, "What are you doing?"
So you're a high school principal and a vocational high school principal, and you've never worked in a high school. And
I avoided high school for 16 years.
Yeah,
16 years. I didn't want to go to high school.
Yeah,
but it was 6 years. Again, the folks over there at Putnam were fantastic. I mean, we really did some nice work. And again, Gary, as you know, we did work with JFY Net, which is really beneficial.
We were there at the time, yeah.
Really beneficial in what we were doing from a math perspective. And I think when we have partners such as yourself and really getting myself acclimated to all the partners and the workings of the school, I mean, we really did it was some great work. And Putnam has not looked back. I mean, they've just gotten better.
Well, the new building, all of that, yeah.
I mean, upon my departure, I mean, they just built on it, and they just got even better, which was fantastic to see. So in 2010, I left Putnam, and I went down to Hartford Public Schools, in which I actually worked in central office for 5 years, had a number of roles. I mean, you name it, it's pretty much I was in it, between a director of school design, which is just all school reform stuff. I was an interim director of elementary education. I was director of secondary schools. I was director of school choice. I was the director of operations, athletics, and special projects. I mean, and all those roles, there was just so much learning that went on. And so mm-hmm. I'm really, I was really appreciative of the opportunities that were afforded me in Hartford. From
a how did that happen? How did you get to Hartford?
I got a call from the assistant superintendent of secondary schools and indicated that she had heard about the work that we were doing in Springfield.
Really?
And actually called twice. The first time, I don't think I was really interested. And she called the second time. And when she's talked about the scope of work, especially with the school reform and school transformation work, it was so intriguing. Because it was from a pre-K-12 perspective, and they were, you know, portfolio schools, different types of schools.
Right,
specialized, you know, you had magnet schools, you had schools that specialized, that were Montessori, schools that specialized in allied health, you had law and government, you had engineering schools, you had culinary arts schools. It was just really just a whole plethora of different opportunities and innovation, and that really intrigued me. So I made the switch over. And again, you just gain different roles. So there was so much that I learned that really were a benefit, believe it or not, coming here to Madison Park in 2015. Yeah. And so then, you know, I transitioned. Someone actually, to get to how I got here to Madison Park, someone in the Office of the Human Resources had left Hartford and came to Boston to work in human capital here. And she was working, she was working in human capital in Hartford, moved the human capital in Boston, and saw this position and called me and says, Kevin, you have to look at this position. And at first I looked at it, I'm not going back to schools. I've been working in central office for 5 years. And, you know, I mean, I'm enjoying the, you know, the global effect of the work. She says, no, but I think if you read what they're asking for, you've really got a lot of this. And it's not a principal's position. It's, you know, again, it's similar to, and being very familiar with the regional, how the regional vocational schools operates, like, you know, you're a superintendent of the school. So I looked at it and I says, you know what I'll do? And her name was Crystal. I said, Crystal, what I'll do is I'll go for the interview. At least I'll give you that. I'll go for the interview, because she was kind of headhunting, and that was great for her being the beginning. And I think it was around to be in early January of 2015. And I got here about a little bit over an hour, well before the interview. And he asked me to sit down and ask, you know, do you mind if I walk around for a while? And he says, no, knock yourself out. And the more I walked around that school, I just felt like, wow, there's something special here. It is
walking around Madison Park.
I said, I get a good, you know, how you get a feel and a sense.
Yeah. Yeah.
And it was upon me.
Really?
Lo and behold, the interview went fantastic. The interview
Who interviewed you?
God, it looked like it was a panel of almost 20 people in the office.
No kidding.
You had the interim headmaster, which was Dr. Al Holland.
Oh, Aldi. Yeah, yeah, yeah.
And he was there, as well as, I know we had two students, but we had people from the school site council. We had teachers. We had parents. We had community members there. I mean, it was quite an interview panel.
Who was the superintendent at that time?
At that time, it was John McDonough.
John McDonough
was the interim superintendent, and so I went through the interview and waited, and I got a week later got a call to meet with John McDonough and Ross Wilson on a Saturday of all things. So I drove up and met with them down. They were down at Court Street at the time. They weren't yet here in Roxbury. But we were there about a couple of hours, and they made the recommendation. And, you know, lo and behold, I was here at Madison Park. And my first day was June 1st of 2015, and I've been here ever since.
Wow, what an interesting path from Hartford, Springfield to Hartford.
Yeah.
And then just,
You're talking
on a chance.
Three of New England's largest school districts. You know, I'm just so, again, I'm very blessed to be able to really have those experiences in these three public school systems.
So we're talking about 1988.
Yep.
1988 to right now, to 2020.
Yeah.
Wow. That's 22 years. No, it's more than 32 years.
This is year 33.
Wow. Yeah. 33 years. Holy cow. And you're still smiling.
Hey.
And seriously, you don't look any the worse for wear. I mean, does this guy look like he's been in the trenches for 33 years?
Well, you figure, when you shave your head, you can't see all the gray. So.
Hey, well, that's a good strategy. Very good strategy. So that's how you got to, that answers the question. How did you get to Boston?
Yeah.
But wait, we didn't cover anything about did you do any formal training in vocational ed?
No, I mean, again, no. That was, the, you know, and I think, you know, lo and behold, since I did work in industry and we get industry, but that wasn't the consideration for me moving to Putnam. I mean, that was something that the superintendent, I saw something in me that he thought that would be a benefit from a leadership perspective.
Yeah.
And that was the move. So not having any inclination on how vocational schools work and inner workings. And trust me, it was trial by error.
But I'm let me tell
you, those folks at Putnam, I mean, they really fast track the education and really get you to understand how, you know, what it's all about.
Yeah.
It's like, you know, the program advisory boards and the such. And so that became it. And then even when I went to Hartford, that was part of my duties and responsibilities as well. Even though Hartford did not have its own Hartford Public School vocational school, we had various programs that were considered career tech. And so having that experience really helped us out. We actually started an auto tech program at Buckley High School, which was great.
Uh-huh.
But one of the things that, you know, just a few of the programs that we started, but it was always something that was always growing and has just continued again to be a part of who I am and my makeup in the educational scheme of things.
Okay. Well, that's very interesting. Okay. So let's shift over to kind of a more philosophical topic, inequality. You've been living in this country for a long time and working in the public schools in this country for a long time. How did you first become aware of the whole idea of inequality?
Just going through the school system in Patterson. I mean,
or just being alive.
I mean, you know, just growing up in Patterson and seeing it. I mean, it was something in which, you know, we did, the only whites that we saw were always in a position of power, which was the police most of the times, or people working in an office. They were lawyers, and we didn't. And that's what we saw. What we saw on our blocks. I mean, you saw poverty, you saw unemployment, you saw these things. And it's something in which, you know, I was just thankful to have a mother and a grandmother who said that was not going to be my destiny. That wasn't, you know, I wasn't raised to be that way. That we were raised to be successful, and successful is being educated and really having gainful employment and making something out of yourself. But I saw it in the public schools in which I grew up in. Yeah, and Gary,
in Patterson.
I mean, Gary, when you have classes of 45 kids, that doesn't make any sense. These, you know, special education was just coming around. Public law 142 was just gaining, I mean, in the 70s. I went to school in the 60s and into the 70s. So there was no public. I mean, there wasn't anything that students who couldn't read or write, they weren't getting.
None of that. There was none of that.
And so when you see that, you have a system that was, I mean, wasn't the best of things in the 60s and 70s. And a quick note, Patterson had been under state receivership since 1980, you know, when they started in 1989, just until a couple of years ago, the state just took them off. So, and I'm saying, well, the schools weren't that good before that, because I'm going back to where I was educated. So you see these things. You see how kids can't read and write. You see this, and they're just pushed along. And so, you know, when I look back on it, I mean, what moral good did that do?
But you came out of that school system. You must have come out of that school system with a pretty good foundation.
Well, because one, I had an acumen for mathematics, and teachers caught on to it. And it was when I look back, but again, you talk about inequities, and I use the term inequities, how they saw that. And I'm going back to fourth grade. I can remember it just distinctly. Fourth grade is when a teacher, and her name was Miss George, to believe it or not, talked to my mother and indicated, your son has, there's something going on with him with math. I'm going to give him, and she said, she explained the whole problem. I'm going to give him a fifth grade math book, and he's going to work in the back, you know, away from everyone else.
No kidding.
But I'm saying though, there had to be more of me in that. There had to be more of me. I mean, it wasn't that I was unique or special. There were more.
Why didn't the other kids get that math?
Why didn't they get that opportunity? And we were all predominantly Black. But why didn't they get that? And you know, and it's something that, you know, to this day, you're just thankful that it happened for you.
No kidding.
And each year, you know, we travel in groups and teachers give reports. So each, you know, my report was, you know, my math background was fantastic. But again, you're seeing more and more kids falling off. And one of the things going into high school with inequity, when I looked at it, I had an opportunity to get bussed out of Patterson, where my peers went to Patterson Eastside, which at the time, you know, it was before Joe Clark, and which Patterson Eastside was not the place to go to get educated. But I had an opportunity because I was bussed out to a predominantly white school district, you know, school.
Yeah.
In which I had that opportunity. But you saw the inequity because, again, I felt there were students, my peers, that were just as talented as I was,
yeah,
if not more. And we got the opportunities and they didn't. And
what grade was that when you started getting
bussed? I was a freshman in high school.
Freshman in high school. So it was like the Metco program here.
It's actually a prep school that I went to.
No kidding. A private prep school?
Private prep school that I went to.
Really? Yeah. Where?
It's actually closed now. Newman Prep School.
Newman Prep, where?
In Wayne, New Jersey.
Well, it's no kidding. So who put the finger on you as the kid that should get bussed out to that school?
Believe it or not, it was an assistant principal.
So from fourth grade, you were kind of identified as a kid with promise. Exactly.
But I wasn't the easy, trust me, Gary, I wasn't the easiest student to deal with either. My mother got a few calls. I mean,
yeah,
I'd get a call, you know, she'd get a call at the beginning of the market period and my mother would do some tuning up and then I would be great the second half of the market period until the next. But they saw something. She actually, you know, started talking to my mother and my mother had a friend who was in education at Patterson Eastside, was a school counselor. They got together, and next thing you know, I was on a bus being bussed out of Patterson to Newman Prep.
Wow.
You learn a lot because, one, you had to come in a shirt and tie every day, which was new to me. I went to schools that were predominantly Black. I mean, Gary, I mean,
yeah.
I think in all my years of going through Patterson Public Schools, I think I might have saw 10 white kids, you know, going through the schools I went to. But now I'm in a situation in which there are only three Black students in the entire school.
Wow.
And again, wow. being in to the point where you have to really prove yourself.
Wow.
And it was really great because, again, I'm very competitive by nature. And one of the things, you know, my mother instilled in me that no one is better than you. And it was just something where I kept my nose to the grindstone. My grades were outstanding out there, if I do say so myself. And again, I played sports, which was kind of a stereotype. Well, you know, the Black kid coming up here, he gotta be good at something.
Of course. Yeah. Yeah.
And so,
white guys can't jump.
Yeah.
Yeah.
But those are some of the things when you're seeing, I was actually better in academics than I was in athletics, you know? And so it was just really proving yourself, but you just see it. You can just feel it every single day.
Did you ever get any overt or covert discrimination while you were there at that school?
Believe it or not, Newman Prep, they really looked after me. They really, I mean, would I hear things, you know, someone dropping the inbox? Yeah, I did. I mean, I'm not going to sit there and
say,
but you would hear it. You'd hear it on the bus, you know, when you're on the bus.
Yeah.
But would someone say it right to my, I didn't have someone just come out there and do just the overt stuff and just doing this, you know, the over the top. No, didn't hear that.
Yeah.
One, because I think they didn't know what kind of reaction they would get from me with the unknown. But I think, and two, the defense of some other white students, really, they really protected me. They really came to the front. But it was it was something that was an awakening for me as well, is that, you know, growing up in Patterson and hearing about the atrocities that were going on in our neighborhoods and the prejudice and inequities and the social injustices that were going on. But on the other side, here are white people who really had a true concern about me. And not because I could hit a baseball or shoot a basketball. It's that they accept me for who I was. And so, you know,
really?
it was something to behold. And, you know, it's a great, and I only was there for 2 years because then my mother moved to Willingboro. And I actually had to, she asked the question, do you want to continue going to private school? And I said, no, I want to go back to public school. I mean, that's where my bread and butter was. I was used to that. And sure enough, I went to Willingboro High School. And Willingboro is a community that's very diverse. It's a very diverse community. At the time, it was. White families, black families, mixed interracial couples. And that's something that we didn't see a lot of in Patterson.
Really? Interracial couples?
In Willingboro, again.
Wow. When is this? What years is this?
And this is in the late 70s. So this is 1978. Yeah. So you saw a very progressive.
Holy cow, and really?
Like Willingboro's a great place to raise kids. And I only had 2 years left of high school, went to Willingboro High School. And again, I often mack when you go to public schools, you know, your grades go down because the restrictions and the competition isn't as such. But my grades were still good. And again, continue to play sports. But, you know, you really didn't see the polarization as much.
Uh-huh. And
it might have been there, but, I really wasn't focused on it.
Uh-huh.
But, you know, going to college, going to Western New England at that time, in which over like 90% of the student body is white. Well, you saw it every day. You saw it every day on that campus. And it became it became a personal challenge to me to finish Western New England.
Is that because of that? Can you just talk a little bit about how that manifested itself?
Well, because one, you begin to become, as you get older, you become more aware of your surroundings.
Yeah.
You become more aware of inequity. You become more aware of how people are perceiving you. That, you know, I wasn't just that jock coming up here on scholarship, you know, just to play basketball. And again, when they ask someone that, well, what are you majoring in? Well, see, you can't say PE because, Western England doesn't have physical education as a major. So it had to be English or philosophy. Yes. No, it's mathematics. That's what I do. And that's what really got me to saying, I got to finish here, because despite how people are looking at me and, you know, in a certain way, and that we, you know, that not a lot of blacks were graduating from Western New England. A lot of the friends that I came in with never finished and say, well, you'll be out of here too, you know, right after us.
Really?
It just became so personal that I had to finish. Wow. At Western New England, even though there were times in which I wanted to transfer. But it was just, you know, again, you see kids from who are upper middle class to some who are high class kids. Here it is, you know, my mother was scrambling just to make ends meet, you know, to get me up here and do some great things. And I said, these people are not better than me. They're just not.
Wow.
And I think that's something that I've tried to instill in my own children.
Yeah.
And I think they begin to see that over a four-year period, see that again. I'm a guy who's going to grind it out every single time. If it's
did the professors, treat you badly?
No, believe it or not, there was one of my math, he was the department chair of mathematics, Dr. Dennis Luciano. I haven't spoken to him in, decades. But he really looked at me. He's another guy who he met with me. He wasn't even my advisor. But he always made it a point to talk to me.
Really?
Yeah, he says, you know, here it is. He says, Kevin, you know, you're in a department. Look who you're with. You're with a bunch of white people. And yet you're the only one in this department. And he used to ask me how you feel about that. And I says, you know what? I said, I use his motivation. He says, good. Continue to let that motivate you. And others in the math department, with the exception of a couple, but that's how they made me feel.
Wow.
Because I think without telling me, they saw what was occurring.
Uh-huh.
And we've got this black kid here, in which there aren't many black mathematicians, but yet he's still here.
Yeah.
And so, you know, again, you saw that push where if I ever had something that was going sideways, I'd go to him. And what you saw, I didn't, again, since, you know, that was my major, you know, all the other things, you know, English language arts and social sciences. And I mean, I knew how to read. I knew how to comprehend. I mean, I could do well in that. But, you know, math was getting tougher. It was more theory based, something that I had no practice in.
Yeah.
And so they kind of shielded me from a lot because, again, they were so supportive of me.
Yeah.
Not just pushing it through, because trust me, they made me work.
How high did you go in math?
I got to do, I think between, obviously, you do the trigonometry. I think
calculus.
Calculus 1, 2, and 3, differential equations, probability and statistics. We did math theory. Obviously, there was a lot of theory courses, and theory is just, I mean, the first day, I said, where the numbers at? Where the numbers at? But, you know, to get into theory was really kind of difficult. Again, just utilizing their strengths and, again, and some will. But I also minored in statistics. So I just, you know, took stats 1, stats 2, and all those. Yeah. And, you know, I'm really intrigued about stats. If I had to do it over again, I probably would have majored in statistics. But that really intrigued, because it helps me, again, as you know, with all the stuff I see today when we're looking at disaggregating data.
It's all data.
It's all data.
Data all over the place. So let's talk about inequality, or leave it in inequality just to start with,
sure,
in education now. So, you know, we had Brown versus Board of Education in 1954, and that fixed everything, right? That took care of everything.
That was the intent.
Yeah. So you've been in public and mostly public, but some private education all your life. Right now, what do you how does it strike you right now as far as the way that minority kids are handled in education now, all these years after Brown versus Board?
Well, I wanted to say with Brown, if I can digress a bit.
Yeah, Gary, sure. Go ahead.
About Brown.
Yeah.
I think the intentions of Brown were good.
Yeah.
But there was a residual consequence that occurred, because as the schools were supposed to integrate with students, it didn't integrate the educators. And thousands upon thousands of educators did not work. They weren't integrated into schools. And so when we talk about today, about why aren't Blacks and Latinx individuals getting into teaching, well, that's a residual effect, because after you've lost your job, if I was a principal at a Black school and all of a sudden my school, all the students are leaving because of integration, I don't have a job anymore. So, and white schools weren't quick to hiring us. So now, what's the taste in educators' mouths right now? What's that taste about their kids coming up? Don't be an educator, because they won't take you.
Wow.
They won't take you. We lost generations of future and prospective Black and Latinx educators. And it wasn't the, and trust me, that wasn't the intent on
no,
me.
But it
occurred.
Are there data that support that?
I mean, there are books I can, you know, it's a book that I'm reading now.
Yeah.
It's by Derek Bell.
Oh yeah.
And it's, oh God, what is it?
Yeah. A recent book?
Silent Covenants. He wrote it back in he wrote it back in, I want to say 2005, 2006. Reading it. But he mentions it. But that stuff, you can look it up, and it's documented.
Well, that is that's very interesting. I have never heard that before. I've never thought of it before.
But again, it's an unintended consequence.
Sure.
It's a great thing. And
sure.
And the other, but what happens, the educators didn't come with it. And so now when we talk about, you know, that we don't have individuals of color in this field, well, that was set up by, you know,
by 66 years ago.
Yeah, that was set up by this.
Yeah.
And so again, I know when I said that I would have some interest in teaching, and I want to go back. I'm going back to when I was in college.
Yeah.
I thought about it.
Yeah.
I mean, they was quickly dismissed by folks around me. You don't want to do that. You don't want to do that. You're not going to make any money doing that. I mean, my first salary, I can tell you my exact salary in 1988, $19,192. My first salary. It's like it was yesterday.
That's more than you're making today.
Yeah. If you put it by an hourly rate.
Yeah.
but so now we fast forward.
Yeah.
Brown was supposed to be that litmus test of integration and getting
your
mix. Schools are more segregated now. I mean, it's well documented. Schools are more segregated now than they ever were. And it's so unfortunate. We look at some of our urban schools, and not just here in Boston or Springfield or Hartford where I've been, but you look across the country. You know, our most neediest kids go to quote unquote those schools that aren't good.
Yeah.
It's because the needs are so high.
Yeah.
The needs are so high, and we don't address the needs, as opposed to, you know, here in, I mean, you know, everything is great with Boston, with the exam schools and the pilot schools and how they operate. But you look at our neighbor, you look at our open enrollment high schools, they have the highest need students, you know, with the most need, but yet you don't always get the resources. And so you're juggling between, do I get a counselor or do I have a math teacher? Well, MCAS, I mean, assessment, school accountability isn't going anyplace. So what do you do? Well, social emotional effects go out the window, which is what these kids need.
Exactly.
And so these are things. So, you know, you're caught in a conundrum.
Yeah.
Every single day, every single week, month and year about what to do. And it's always, well, these schools are terrible. Well, no, it's about why are they always concentrated in X number of schools, in X number of school districts, and X number of urban centers across the country.
Yeah.
It's so that's where the inequities fall. And, you know, accountability, I believe in accountability. Don't make no mistake about that.
I feel
that testing is important, but testing shouldn't be a determinant on a student's level or a school's ability to operate. And so those are some of the inequities that I see that are just still going on today. And it's so unfortunate. It's just so unfortunate. And the kids and their families are the ones who pay the price.
Well, they're the first ones who pay the price, but eventually everybody pays the price.
They pay the price. Gary, the whole community, the communities pay the price. Everyone, the economic development of cities, because if you don't have an informed and educated workforce,
you got nothing.
What do you got?
Yeah, you got nothing. So we don't have a diverse educational workforce because of the lingering effects of 1954.
Well, I wouldn't say that, you know, that's one of the reasons. I'm sure there's a number of other factors that go into that. But that's an important, I think it's an important one that goes overlooked at times.
Yeah. Yeah. Well, it's, as far as I'm concerned, it's always going overlooked. I never even heard it said before. It's then we had busing here in Boston in the early 70s.
Oh, my
that
Lord.
Was,
and yes, I mean, the effects are still going on
absolutely.
Today.
Of course they are.
How many, and we're talking, what's that, 47 years ago?
73, was it?
73. Yeah. And you're still feeling the effects of this. And it's something when we talk about inequality and inequities. I mean, it's just, it's 2020 and we haven't figured this out. And we can't keep pointing the finger at each other. No, how do we come together with some solutions? And solutions is a team effort. I mean, there's a 2010 documentary, and I'm sure everyone Waiting for Superman. As a matter of fact, I just saw it again the other day. I mean, Superman isn't showing up. There isn't one educator in this country, I don't care how good they think they are.
Yeah.
One person is not just going to come in and be the panacea for all education in one district, one state, or the entire country. It is a team effort that's going to really tackle this.
But it means money, you know, it means shifting money around and putting more money into places like Madison Park and Brighton High, you know, Burke and all the inner city schools.
And, you know, Gary, it goes back where you have this high need.
Yeah.
High need. And it's always, well, you have X number of FTEs. You can't get this done. Well, if students are coming in, you look at demographics of students and the needs that they possess. Well, it's just a matter of meeting that need. It's not.
Well, who's saying you have X number of FTEs?
So this could be talk from a number of people from.
So without having any idea of what is actually required.
What is
people are saying, hey, you get all this money. What the hell? What's the matter with
money.
You?
You got all this money and you can't make this thing with all the resources. You can't make this happen.
Does anybody has anybody ever actually costed out what it would really take to make a Madison Park or a Brighton High function the way it should?
No. I mean, it's to the point where, because everything is it's per pupil based. I mean, if you have X number of students, X number of special education students, and.
But if you did a budget for your school, You could do that, right? You could just sit down and write a budget for what you actually need.
Yep.
To run that school. Have you ever done that?
I have never done it. I've never thought about it. I mean, because again, you're so ingrained about getting what you get and making the best of that money in that pool.
Well, you know, I don't want to, you know, give you more work to do, but it would be an interesting exercise just to sit down and, you know, write a personnel chart and supplies and so forth. And just what would it actually take to run this place the way it ought to be run?
Yeah.
It would be interesting to know, because of course, you know, we know that you and all the rest of the open enrollment schools are underfunded, but you don't know by how much.
Yeah.
Is it by, you know, you don't know how much. I'll bet it's not a trivial amount.
And, you know, and when you look at the budget, you know, people on the surface, wow, it's a lot of money to run that school.
Yeah, sure. Like,
But again, when you break down the actual need, because you all have student. I mean, granted,
it ain't a lot of money.
From a student who's a general education student to your most neediest special education student who is very expensive, and that could just be one student.
Oh, yeah.
I mean, so
when you look
at that need. I mean, it's something in which people need to look at. Stop looking at the number. Look at the need and what's required. That's something that Jeffrey Canada, you know, down at the Harlem Children's Zone, that's what he did. That's what KIPP does. You know, KIPP does. I mean, the charter schools, some of the charter schools, that's what they do.
Yeah.
And I know some, you know, it's something in which you always hear that term, well, the money follows the kid. Well, not always. Not always.
Yeah, some money follows the kid.
Some money, but not always.
Yeah, that's not to say that an adequate amount of money follows the kid.
But I think that's why, you know, there's so much, you know, we depend on. I go back to your organization with JFYNet. We need partners to do this.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, here at Madison Park, we've been very fortunate to have some outstanding partners, even some post-secondary to industry, who have really started to fill those gaps, you know, for needs and supports for students.
Well, I'll tell you, Kevin, you have done a hell of a job of attracting support to Madison. Madison Park, you know perfectly well, Madison Park has been not exactly the highest regarded school in the city for a long time. I go back to the middle 80s at Madison Park.
That's
and
right.
It has never been, you know, it's always been the runt of the litter. And you've really done a lot in your 5-6 years to turn it from a place nobody wants to talk about to a place that gets talked about all the time. Not always the way you'd like it to be talked about, but it's, you know, you're on the agenda and it's people are coming in.
It's something in which, you know, one of the things coming in is,
it ain't easy.
Thank you for that, Gary. But again, I got to be very humble with that, because it's not just me. And as I indicated, I am not Superman.
Of course not.
That's a lot of hands. It's a lot of hands.
Yeah. Yeah.
A lot of hands have been involved in this.
Yeah.
And I think, you know, one of the things we Madison Park's history is well known, even coming into the position. But what happens, we were all determined we will not be the laughing stock. We will not be the run of the litter of this district. We will not be. It became a mindset and a culture shift no matter what the media says about us, no matter what is said, this will be an institution of high powered learning at all times. We will produce champions out of this place across the board, academically, vocationally, athletically, from an extracurricular perspective. We want champions. And, you know, we continue to work on that every single day. And despite sometimes you read something that's not too pleasant in a newspaper or something else, it doesn't deter us from really just pushing on and just really progressing forward.
Well, I think you're the first head of that school who ever uttered the words early college or dual enrollment. I mean, it would have been, nobody would have dared suggest that you could do college courses at Madison Park. They would have been laughed out of town.
I tell you, Nasir, we go back to inequality and inequities.
Yeah.
You know, I know RocksMap, when you say RocksMap, you say that 5 years ago, people would be laughing, you know? I mean, it was just...
Yeah.
That became a focal point for us.
Yeah.
My dual enrollment and early college aren't. And it's been it's probably the most successful program that we have. And we have quite a few successful programs.
Yeah.
But here's a program in which, you know, we produce Boston's the first Boston, the city of Boston, and Boston Public Schools, college grad, you know, 2-year graduates.
Yes.
We
yes,
produce
yes,
them,
yes.
And we have one in the queue for this upcoming year too.
Yeah.
I mean, it's but and why Madison Park? And the question we have: why not Madison Park?
Well, exactly, exactly.
And I mean, I feel like dual enrollment and early college program is probably the best in the state. I say that.
But I'll tell you, you know, the reason why it's happening is because you said we're going to do this and you didn't let people get in your way. That's not to say that there aren't a lot of other people who contributed and you didn't wash all the windows and sweep all the floors yourself. But, you know, when the guy at the top says, people, we're going to do this. And everybody says, oh, please. But you just keep saying, we're going to do it. We're going to do it. And then eventually it happens. Exactly. You didn't let anybody discourage you.
No. And it's just, you know, and again, it's, you know, when people try to even minimize it, and it's something that's a little bit discouraging, but this isn't occurring anywhere else in the city, but it's not even occurring anywhere else. And again, there are programs, but no one has seen this type of growth, especially from a school in which the expectations were so low of the general public, and the perceptions of the school were such that who would ever expect it? And I says, you know, always expect the unexpected. And again, just more and more greatness is going to come out of this building.
The denigration or the low esteem in which inner city schools are held, how much of that is racial? How much of that is just economic or just social class? I mean, what is it? Is it still Brown versus Board? Is it still or busing? Is it still fundamentally racial?
It's a number of things. It's racial, it's class, it's economic. I mean, just look at some of the area codes which we come out. Roxbury, if you look at the median income of families, it's so much lower than someone who was in Charlestown or Hyde Park or West Roxbury to such. You do the same in Mattapan. It's the same thing. You do this in Dorchester, in certain area codes in Dorchester. It's the same thing. You look at certain sections of East Boston. It's the same thing. The demographic may change to Latinx. But these are the students who we get who are converging on our schools and who say that this might be the saving grace for us. So when you're looking at students who are coming from not families or means, and see, it is not just Kevin McCaskill saying it. This is coming from the State Department of Education. It's coming from DESE's numbers. 92% of our students are deemed high needs or at risk.
Right.
74% of our kids are economically disadvantaged.
Right.
I mean, these aren't our numbers that we're creating. These are the numbers coming right from the state.
Obviously,
you know, when you're looking at, and again, I can also tell that our enrollment is climbing back up.
Now,
again, with an increase in enrollment, your demographic stays the same. Well, that means more students with more needs.
Of course. Well, why do you take all those kids? Why don't you go get some rich white kids?
Hey, we take care of the community. It's all about community first, Gary. Community first. I want to go on record. It's community first. Those folks in our community, they get served first. You know, because that was a possible solution, as you can recall, Gary.
About
Madison Park longer than I, making this a regional school, which would have opened the doors. So every student who didn't get into Minuteman and Norfolk Aggie and Blue Hills, they would have been open season, and which would have eliminated, again, we go back to inequality and inequity.
Yeah.
We lost seats for Black and Brown kids here in Boston.
Let's talk about technology.
Sure.
You've done a whole lot with technology. How much can technology do to ameliorate any of these problems, the inequities, the disparities in opportunity? How much can technology level the playing field?
A great deal, Gary. From a vocational perspective, when we look at things through a vocational lens, the more technologically savvy our students are, they are increasing the access to opportunity. As you know, Gary, across the board, every industry sector is going more technical. From a technology perspective, if you don't have those type of skills, you can't make people money. And if you can't make them money, you don't work. So if we can really embed and integrate technology across the board, not only in the academics, but most importantly, into our vocational programs across the board. Now they're having just applicable skills, Gary, that they can apply to certain sectors to make them more attractive and more marketable to industry. And each going, just think about it, over a 4-year period accumulating all these skills, a student can literally make a decision to go into an entry-level position more skilled than a 20 or 30-year-old and earn a competitive salary, mm-hmm. or decide to go on to a 4-year to enhance their skill, mm-hmm. to even increase their earning power. That's what technology can do. And it's, again, as I indicated, it's across the board. If you're, you know, for computer-aided drafting in some of our heavy trade areas, to a having kids in the program that we have, the actual programming and web development vocational program that we have, in our IT program, because as we also know, those two fields are very white. They're extremely white. They are devoid of color. Now you have a school that has a 97% base of students of color. Think about, we become a hotbed of recruitment, mm-hmm. for, you know, companies, because they're all talking about diversity. Mm-hmm. Well, this needs to be your farm system, but the farm system has to be in a position to prepare students for all these technologies that are used in industry. So again, we have to really integrate that at a much, I think, even more than we're doing now.
If it's a scale of 1 to 10, where are you right now with your, you know, your capability?
I think we're about a 7. You know, yeah. I think I couldn't say that a few years ago.
Yeah.
I couldn't say that. But I think at a 7, where everyone understanding the importance,
yeah.
and actually with everyone really integrating, I think, you know, obviously COVID has forced people to use technology,
yeah.
in a way.
That's kind of a subtopic. Has COVID really kicked the ball down the road in terms of getting technology integrated across the board?
Because one, it's put technology in the hands of students who really didn't have access to a lot of technology.
Right. And right now, essentially all academic instruction is going on the screen now.
On the screen, absolutely.
Even when they come in for those 2 days or whatever it is, they're still
on the screen. Yeah.
Yeah. So in one half a year, it has moved the entire education system into online instruction.
A new realm. And, you know, Gary, at some point in time, you know, despite the, you know, folks, the gloom and doom individuals that we sometimes come across, this will end. I mean,
oh, yeah, of course it will.
This is going to end. But think about what we're developing.
But meanwhile,
some of the remote strategies. Think about when we come back full strength.
Yeah.
With these other tools from a technology perspective.
Yeah.
Integrate those into the in-house and face-to-face learning.
Yeah,
it's going to be a powerful medium. It really is. And I salivate over the opportunities.
What are you doing anything to prepare for that, to get people ready for that?
Well, again, looking at what are some of those best strategies, you know, when we're talking to departments, when we're talking to individual teachers.
Yeah.
What are some of those strategies that you're utilizing? What are those best practices?
Yeah.
Let's get a library of these best practices across the board, because what works in one can work across content areas, and even from a vocational perspective, they can work.
Of course.
And let's really get a depository of all these best practices. So at your fingertips, you'll be able to pull those. And so that's, I think, the most exciting piece is because now we have teachers talking about it.
Yeah.
They're talking about, they're chronicling it. It's really exciting.
Yeah.
Despite the times that we're in.
Kevin, thank you very much. Boy, this was really interesting.
Thank you for the opportunity. I truly appreciate it. And one of the things I can recall, Gary, you've probably forgotten it, because I've just remembered, you know, the conversations, you know, me and you going back and forth yelling at each other at Putnam. But I said, you know what? At the end of the day, I always want people like Gary Kaplan with me, regardless of where I am. But I mean that sincerely, Gary. I mean, you know, who knows what the future lies for any of us. And, you know, I don't plan on getting out of education anytime soon. But I know I know what, you know, true commitment is, and I know that you have been committed to everywhere I've been. And anyone that shows this type of commitment to our school community, I mean, they're always good with me, and they're going to stick around for a long time.
We would like to thank Kevin McCaskill, the executive director of Madison Park Technical Vocational High School, for joining us this month on the JFY Networks podcast. Join us again next month for part two of this conversation, which will continue and discuss the future of education and Mr. McCaskill's vision for Madison Park. If you have any questions or comments, please navigate to our website, jfynet.org, where you will also find our new Connected Learning page, outlining the array of resources provided by JFY Learning Specialists. Thank you for listening to this podcast. For JFY Networks, I'm Greg Cunningham. This has been a production of JFY Networks.